The book author, Mr. William, became preparation person, right? Here we are talking about cause and condition of depression. So it seems to me he is worrying too much when he's away from his wife or vice versa. That shows to me he may have been stolen love to his wife, became too attached to his wife, in other words, over-attached to his wife. I think this is one of the cause and condition of depression as per Buddhist perspective. I don't know whether it's true or not. This is one question. Second question is, main cause and condition of depression, you have said, depression comes to a person such as in the U.S., could be in another part of the world. Person become loneliness when one retired. You are automatically lost your work friends, etc., so on. So, something like myself from USA, I'm retired, I'm not loneliness, fortunately. So, this too has what is the, I mean, your answer for that, number one and two? Yes. Thank you so much.
All right, now I can answer. The first part you wanted to know, I think I understood your question, was did I think that Mr. Styron was too attached to his wife? Is that right? Well, it was a change from his previous behavior. He had been a very successful writer, very successful, with many friends, a successful, easy life. You know, he made a good living, and all of a sudden he fell into depression, could not make decisions anymore, could not write, didn't want to see anybody except his wife, and he said that he felt afraid all the time, and that she was his only sense of security, and so he didn't want to leave her side. But the important part is that it was a change, a big change from his ordinary functioning. So, was he too attached to his wife? Yes. He didn't feel confident to be in the world by himself, on his own, to make decisions, to go about his regular life. Now, the second thing you said was about retirement. What I meant to convey is that I think as we are living longer, healthier lives, we must prepare for what we are going to do when our work life is finished. Now, I'm a psychologist, so if I choose to, I can work until I die if I want to and if I am capable. So for me, it's not so much of a difficulty, all right, because of the way that my work is performed. I can always do it. It's not heavy labor. I don't need strong muscles to do it. I just need a good mind, right? But if you have the kind of a job where there is automatic retirement age, or it's physically taxing and you can't do it anymore, it's important to think about what is going to give me joy and a social life when I retire. All right? So you are a lucky man. You figured it out.
So one question is,
okay.
You can read?
Yes. Yes, here's a question. My question is, mental illness such as depression, anxiety disorder, schizophrenia, etc., is largely associated with a brain, or in other words, caused by complex chemical reactions in the brain. So why is it termed as mental illness, not as brain disorder? Well, I think that's a great question. You know, neuroscience, understanding the brain, is very new. It's very, very new. I began as a psychologist in 1980, and I remember maybe about 1990, I said to a friend of mine who was a neuropsychologist, Ernie Bryant, Ernie, when are we going to understand the brain? And he said, well, Sonny, with computers, maybe in 100 years. So we're understanding so much more. But you know, some of these terms were developed long ago, you know, before we had an understanding of brain and neuroscience was developing. So that would be my best answer to you. Now, I think there's a difference between depression, major depression, which could be caused by, you know, as I told you, shrinkage in the hippocampus or some true brain abnormality. Schizophrenia, bipolar, some of them are serious mental illnesses, and I don't mean to say depression is not serious, it is, but it is not in the same category, I don't think, as depression or anxiety or some of the other things that you've mentioned. Okay? So I'm in agreement with you. I think it would be lovely to call it a brain disorder as opposed to a mental illness. And what I'm learning, and this is very new for me, I spoke about it just briefly last year, but I've trained now for a whole year in how to repair certain brain disorders. There's new technology, there's new science and research is showing us how to heal depression and anxiety and trauma and concussion, by the way, and addiction using other means. It's very exciting, but it's very new. It's on the cutting edge. Not very many people have access to it. So thank you for your question. It's a great question.
Hello, over there.
Yes, I see you.
It is such an honor and privilege to have a great motivational talk from doctors. Thank you for your speech. So I have two questions. First one, for depressed person, which step is more suitable should he or she be taken first? So the first question is, To overcome by own self. Or second one is by landing someone for help, by consulting someone or blurting out your circumstances. This was my first question. And my second question is about the illness. For any curable disease, a person who are having an ill of curable disease, it is always easy to encourage them and get rid of depression because this can be cured. But what about incurable disease like AIDS and tumors, and which is impossible? Suppose a victim was depressed about the death, and how can you treat them, and do you have any evidence? Thank you.
Well, the first question was about, I think I understood you, so you correct me if I did not understand. I think you were asking, should a person try to heal themselves from depression, or should they ask for help? And sometimes people are ashamed to ask for help. And when someone comes to see me about depression, I say to them, guess what? The healthiest person in the family comes for help first. Okay? It is a strength, in my view, to say, I am suffering, I'm tired of suffering, I need help. And I think for me, at least, and I hope for most people, there's always something new to learn. And so if I'm suffering with depression, well, you heard my story. I kept looking and looking and looking for what was the problem, what was causing me to feel so badly. And several people said, well, maybe you should take medication. I said, I don't think it's going to help because it doesn't feel that way. So I would say, if you have an attitude of curiosity, maybe a little adventure, it's good to ask for help. Why not? Why not? I'm not sure that I completely under... Did I answer your question, the first part?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. The second part you said, what about people with incurable disease? HIV, AIDS, tumor. I didn't understand the rest. Well, I think the goal is to help people live the best lives they can live, despite whatever their circumstances are. So a few years ago, I was giving a training for psychologists, and a woman came to my training who had had a Fulbright scholarship to go to Africa and set up mental health clinics for women and children with AIDS. And she said that she would have a group of women, maybe 20 in her group, and a week later, half of them would be dead. But, you see, and we said, did it feel hopeless to you? And she said, not at all. It didn't feel hopeless because there was so much joy among the women and they were helping each other. And I was teaching them ways to cope with their sadness and with their fear and with their fears for their children who they were going to be leaving behind. So, sometimes, as you all know, there is no cure for whatever the situation is. And then I think our job is really to help people with our skills to live the best way they can until they die. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Yes.
Here's the next question. I have several. Is DID... you put deficiency identity disorder related to depression. It's actually dissociative identity disorder. And DID, dissociative identity disorder, is a very severe reaction, almost always to very, very severe abuse and neglect, usually sexual abuse in childhood of a very severe nature. And what happens is that the person, the child in this case, learns a way to not be present. They take themselves away, find a way to compartmentalize the experience, and sometimes develop a completely different personality to deal with the stress of that experience. So it's too big of a question for me to go into great detail about, but of course, these people become severely depressed. And is a very difficult situation. It's a very difficult treatment. And I've only had two cases in all my years of doing therapy. So 1980 to 2016, 36 years, two cases. Very difficult to treat. Very difficult to diagnose because, you know, 1 week I'm talking to one personality in this person. Another week I'm talking to a different personality. So, yes, it's certainly related to depression. Usually, at least in the United States, there are people who specialize in the treatment of DID. It's a highly specialized treatment. Are there differences between the emotional extremes causing the depression and the negative thinking perspectives causing the depression? If so, how and how are you going to treat? Well, I think they're related. I think not always connected, but can be related. So the emotional extremes causing the depression I talked about. So, for example, a divorce, a loss, feelings of betrayal. I think those would be emotional situations that don't necessarily have to do with the person's thinking. You know, if my husband rejects me and goes off with another woman, I'm going to feel badly. And I should feel badly. You know, it's a sad situation. So I don't think I'm going to help a person by saying, well, you just have to think about this differently. I can help them plan a new life, you know, a different kind of a life. But I'm not going to convince them that it was, you know, an okay situation. But you asked about negative thinking. And definitely negative thinking will lead us into depression. I have a friend who said to me, my life feels like every day is garbage soup and every minute is another sip. That's negative thinking, all right? And if I come out in this beautiful day in Dharamsala and the sun is shining and I have wonderful people around me, if I'm thinking this is a bad day and bad things are going to happen because that's just the way it is, of course, it's a depressed way of thinking that ultimately may lead to depression. So they can be related and they can be separated. If it is an emotional extreme, you ask, how am I going to treat? You know, I'm going to help this person get through and resolve the emotions that are causing them such distress, right? I mentioned the woman, the nurse, who said, I don't love my children anymore. And you know, what I began to learn about her was that she was married to an alcoholic man who was very mean, right? And so it wasn't about changing her thinking, it was helping her decide whether to stay in the marriage or not. She ultimately decided to leave the marriage, and guess what? No more depression. She loved her children again, and she loved her life, but she could not live in that negativity. So, with someone who has negative thinking all the time, I'm going to try to help them to think more positively and to see the beauty in their life, whatever that is. It depends upon the person. And to see how I can help them find their joy. And show them that they're, you know, I can think about, oh dear, I have to go to work today. Or I can think, oh my gosh, I'm so lucky I get to go to work today. It's two different things. It's a privilege to go to work today. I hope I answered your question. Here's the next question. What is the relationship of shrinkage of the hippocampus and increasing depression? Well, I wish I could answer that question intelligently, but I cannot. I'm only just beginning to understand it myself. And so I think it's... 1 year from now, you ask me that question, I'll be able to answer it better. But there, all I can tell you is there's a definite correlation. Are there other questions? Yes. Wait a minute, she's going to get you a microphone. Did you say you're Elizabeth Franks from England?
Elizabeth Banks.
Banks. Elizabeth Banks.
What are the things we can do every day, if we are a lady over 60 or anybody over 60, to develop joy with exercises if it's the case that the hippocampus is slowly shrinking? For example, I'm thinking of light or sun or dance. What are some perhaps easy things we can follow?
It's a very good question. I think there are quite a few things we can do, and you already named them, all right? So it is true that in certain areas of the world where there is not a lot of sun, people tend to get depressed. And in many, many northern countries, like in Scandinavia, Alaska, in the United States, people tend to drink more alcohol in the wintertime, which makes things worse. So it's possible to get more light, to just sit in front of bright lights, you know, a light lamp. There's a brand of light lamp in the U.S., I don't know about here, called Light Bright. You can wear it as a visor. It puts light on your eyes at a certain angle that is similar to the sun. So that will help. Certainly singing. I had you sing a song. It's a joyful song, you know. Singing, especially group singing, always helps. You mentioned dance. Of course, moving the body will help. And in fact, we're finding that exercise, vigorous exercise and dance would come under that category, is a great healer for depression. I think paying attention to simple joys. I ask many of my clients to keep a journal of their gratitude, and every night before they go to sleep, to write 10 things that happened during the day that they were grateful for. That perhaps they were grateful for having a beautiful orange at breakfast. And they were grateful for it when they went outside. There were the trees and the sunshine. And perhaps they were grateful for a wife or a husband or a friend who they had communication with that day. So 10 things every day. Gratitude. Gratitude is an enormous healer. and to begin to pay attention to small things that we can be grateful for. A delicious meal, the smile of a child, small things that are easy to notice and easy to have. You know, sometimes we think it's going to be money and riches that's going to bring happiness. And I must tell you, my office is filled with wealthy people who are very depressed. You cannot buy good mental health, and you can't buy happiness. So I think you make a good point that simplicity, simple joys, are a good remedy. Thank you.
Giving back.
Oh, my friend Denise mentioned giving back. If you were here last year, you heard my lecture about 8 ways to well-being, and one of them was altruism, giving back. Finding a way to be of use, you know, volunteering to do something that you are not paid for. Many of my chemically dependent clients who are recovering from alcoholism or drug addiction, I send them to the Humane Society that takes care of animals, and they wash dogs. On Saturday, they give all the dogs a bath, and they take the dogs for a walk that ordinarily wouldn't get any special treatment, and they feel good. It makes them feel better. There was another question here in the front. Yes.
Thomas Delaney, Chiwa de Pigatuna Kacha to Sena, any Kirani, Arila, psychologist in Bechani, Kiranki, Nambeta to the contact Kiranki Nepalani, Pujichi, US.
Wait, I can't hear. I have to put my radio on.
So in English, being a psychologist in United States, do you ever prescribe Buddhist philosophy to your patients? And if so, how has the result been shown?
This is a great question, and it's a timely question. You know, in the West, we've been very slow to recognize yoga and meditation. But now, sometimes people in the West, psychologists, worry that if I prescribe meditation, people will think that I'm prescribing religion. Okay, and they'll be very upset about that. So we don't call it meditation. We call it mindfulness. It's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. And we do it in many different ways. Sometimes we practice, if I have an eating disordered client, a person who starves themselves, or a person who overeats, we'll do a mindfulness exercise, eating together, one bite at a time, tasting each food, thinking about it, or sometimes silent meditation or meditation outdoors. There's a...
What I want to add to that.
Denise, I don't think it's appropriate. Can concussions lead to depression? I'll do yours next. Definitely, definitely. You know, in the United States, we love football. We love football. Every Sunday, everybody watches football. Every Monday night, all the men, many women watch football. But what we are finding, as I said earlier, is that football players have concussions. They're hitting their heads constantly, right? My husband was a football player at a major university. And, you know, you get concussion. Now, he's been lucky. He did not get depression. But many professional football players are committing suicide from concussion, and we're learning more about it. Right? So, yes, definitely. What is your question?
The background for depression. How do you respond to people who come to see you who are dealing with depression due to, like, experiences of depression, like racism?
With symptoms of depression, like...
Systems of oppression.
Oh, with systems of oppression. Yes, of course. Well, it's a big question. More awareness is coming in the United States to our own systems of oppression. Prejudice of any kind, I think, leads to depression and anxiety. If you're always worried that you're going to be discriminated against, you know, that people are not going to like you because of the color of your skin, that you're not going to be allowed to rent or buy property, for example. So when I have a person, a minority group person come to see me, I'm always aware about that. And I find, interestingly enough, oftentimes other psychologists don't ask about it. You know, maybe, you know, I'm a white woman, I'm a privileged woman, and I have to be mindful if I'm dealing with a minority person, to ask a lot of questions about our relationship, what is it going to be like for them to reveal themselves to a white woman, a privileged woman, okay? And to be sensitive, you know, about their experience. My dear friend, Dr. Ana Nogales, works mainly with victims of domestic violence in the Latino community, the Mexican American and South American community in California, and women who have been trafficked, into the sex trade. And all of those women are terribly, terribly depressed, of course. So I think it's difficult work, and I think it's very important to be, as a psychologist, as a therapist, to be sensitive to these issues. And sometimes I find that I have to ask my patients, my clients, to teach me, because I don't know everything about it. Now, some years ago, I wrote a book about African-American women, and I learned a lot about the systemic aspects, you know, of racism and sexism and ageism and the whole realm of disabilities. So I think we have a lot of work to do. Did I answer your question? Do you want to know more? Snuff? Okay.
The Puyutola Naza Tabul Ten Semil Nawayina Naza Dan Semil Nile Kang Tangur Chu Kursam Sesto Di Injina Gurje and Sunshe Rang Puyin.
Okay. When mental illness comes from change, from chronic disease, then what should we treat first, mental illness or the disease? Well, I would hope that I don't have to choose, that I can do both. Because what I know is that a person who has depression, their entire immune system becomes depressed, okay? And if their immune system is depressed, their chronic illness, or even any illness, is going to have a harder time healing. So I would like, if possible, for the treatment to be simultaneous, both the physical aspects and the mental health aspects. I know that in the United States, if you are being treated for cancer, at least in my area, in the San Francisco area, you will automatically be referred to a psychologist who will teach you mindfulness, which is another word for meditation, and will treat any depression that you may be experiencing so that the treatment for the cancer can be more successful, have a better chance of working.
Hello.
There's another one. Oh.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Miss Tony. Thank you.
Oh,
thank
hi.
Thank
hello.
What do you think about hypnosis? What do you think about hypnosis?
Oh, hypnosis.
Once I heard that a lot of Western doctors use hypnosis to treat depression.
Move your.
I heard that many Western doctors use hypnosis to treat depression.
Yes.
This is my first question. And the second question is, you said that old people have more risk of depression because they don't have jobs to do. And my question is there any other reasons?
Yes.
Other than lack of job?
Yeah, there are two questions. The first is, what about hypnosis in the treatment of depression? So it is true that hypnosis can be a very useful treatment for depression. I myself am not trained in hypnosis, although I have experienced hypnosis. Okay? I had a very serious illness in 1990, and I wanted to understand if there were mental aspects to my illness. So I consulted with a man named Dr. David Cheek, who is now deceased, but he was very famous for his treatment of hypnosis. And he did a lot of work with me in clearing to determine if there was some way that I had caused or helped this illness to happen. And it turned out that he said no. But it was good for me to know that, because if there was something I was doing that was contributing, you know, to my illness, I wanted to know about that and I wanted to correct it. Now, your second question was about more depression in the elderly. And, of course, it's not always about job loss. I have a wonderful friend who's a doctor, a woman's doctor. Her name is Dr. Jackie Toten. And she's in her 80s, and she said, "You know, Sonny, old age feels like being stripped of everything that I have loved. I loved my work. I cannot work. I love to read, and my eyes are failing. I love to listen to music, but I don't hear very well. And so it's an experience in loss." And so that could be one reason. It could be chemical. Sometimes elderly people are very successfully treated with antidepressant medication. Just a little bit will make a big difference in their outlook, right? So there can be reduced serotonin levels with aging that are easily treated. Okay. I see two more questions here. I have barking dogs in the background. I think they're applauding. My question is, how does abuse cause depression? If it's of childhood abuse, then the childhood memories would be likely to be repressed. If so, is it repression which leads to depression as the child grows up? So this is a complicated question. I was just reading last night about a doctor who works in a very poor area of the United States where the children have many adverse experiences as they're growing up. They live in dangerous neighborhoods. There are many shootings, a lot of crime, a lot of poverty, poor diet. And she began to see that the more negative experiences children had, the more likely they were to be depressed as children. Well, if you're depressed as a child, you don't do very well in school. You have many difficulties. So, abuse causes higher levels of cortisol in our system. Remember, I talked about that in my presentation. Cortisol are stress hormones, and they are good if we are in danger. They lead to a fight or flight response, right? But if you have high cortisol all the time, it is very wearing on your body. It's wearing on all your body parts, not just your brain. So children who have a significant number of adverse experiences will oftentimes be depressed then or later in their life. If it's of childhood abuse, then the childhood memories would likely be repressed. I think whatever we grow up with, we believe is normal for us. So oftentimes I have people who come into my office, especially men, more often men, who were beaten as children. And they will say, everybody I knew was getting beaten when they were children. So for them, it was normal. They thought that was normal. That's the way it's supposed to be. And so, of course, I explained to them that children are not meant to be hurt. It's not a good way to teach children right from wrong. And that I remember when I was a very little girl, only 4 years old, a neighbor of ours had 9 children, and he beat his children, Mr. Pacini. I never forgot his name, even though I was so young. And he was being investigated to have a top-secret clearance with the military. And an investigator came and knocked on our door and said to my father, "What do you know about Mr. Pacini? We're looking, to give him a top-secret clearance." And my father said, "I don't know anything about him except he beats his children." And he did not get a top-secret clearance. So even way back then, in 1950, people knew it was not right. But if you grow up in a place where everybody is having this experience, you think, well, everybody's having this experience. So it's not necessarily that it is repressed, although it could be that you don't remember. Sometimes we just choose not to remember painful experiences. But oftentimes it's not repressed, it's just that you don't recognize it as a problem or that it was causative. Okay, I think I answered that question. Here is another. Western psychology talks about loving yourself when achieving a mental health state. But on the other hand, Buddhist philosophy claims self-attachment as the root cause of depression or mental illness. Where or how to draw the line there to achieve a healthy mind? I would like to have an answer from both perspectives. I think that the answer lies in the middle. My teacher used to call it the formidable middle. So if I think too highly of myself, if I am full of pride, it is a mistake, and it does not lead to good mental health. It will make me selfish, and I will value myself the more than I value others, and I will be inconsiderate. On the other hand, if I do not value myself at all, if I think that I am worthless, then I will not take care of my body, I will not go to school and educate myself, I will not reach out and help you, and I will not achieve my highest and best in the world so that I can make a contribution. So I think there is a middle ground where I care about myself, I take care of my physical health, I take care of my mental health, and so that I can be of service in the world. All right? So I think it's the middle ground. Yes. Hello.
So my then to us we show this. That and the doctor la show la ni the tam she ya wo show jin na so sa ni. Adu sa me sa shin ni sam ji tu sum de le da ni tu ji che she yi. Ta wo de so sa na mi re da de zin gen zi ni ke wa nam ba so sa ma la ni ta wo ni. Sam ji tu sum de le she yi. Ta dan da 아니 따땡에 멜레바는 다 치워져 질레딩들아라 땡이만 내가 지 치고 삼지다 따들이 고급이 하고 싶어라서 인케나 지 근데 디프레션 중이게 암지지 뭐스데 틸 페이지 담셔나 내가 치워피라와디 뭐라인데 겨 삼부이 삼게스 그런데 그런데 디프레션이 나자디라라 Tadi rik mampu jinggu tu, nampak mampu tu jinggu tu ala. Dah minta mampu sih tu. Ini tandai kerana tak pergi amci nangi juga. Rik kaki tu mangan jinggu, sekarang zala cedap sini. An dinsul lagi kerana ki kaki mangan jinggu na. An dinsul lagi kerana ki lockdown tu kandis nangi, konsol pendo kacau jinggu tu sura. Menjadi tu kandis nanggur. An kesi men nangi juga na. An men di anti-depression nang dinte konyus dinte la side effect mangbu yor dinte nga konyus dinte yore yo ma desra ani kesi di menjo nani singra thagi yor be negap thagi yor be khandar es ya de ta nazar dile pendo ro kya se jun khandar ro jin de sewo ji song ro nan shwe yi thosen na
Thank you for your question and your compliment. It's true that in the West, we do use medication for depression. When I began as a psychologist in 1980, there was antidepressant medication, but it was not very good. It caused a lot of side effects, a lot of sleepiness. But nowadays, in all these years that have followed, antidepressants have become very fine-tuned, depending on what kind of depression you have, and really excellent. But, as I explained in my version of depression, it would not have helped me. So it depends on what kind of depression you have, whether medication is indicated or not. Now, I'm a psychologist, I'm not a medical doctor, so I do not prescribe medication. But when I see a patient, I try to determine if I think medication will be helpful to them, and then if I think so, I refer them to a psychiatrist who will evaluate and also decide, is this a good fit for them to have medication? Now, you also asked me about why, I think you asked me, you correct me, I think you asked me why there is so much depression in the West. And I will tell you my opinion, but it's just my opinion, and I don't know for sure. I think one thing that has happened in the West, that our dream began to be about acquisition, about acquiring things, more and more money, more and more things, more and more status. And people have moved away from a spiritual practice. When I was a little girl, everybody I knew went to church. They had a spiritual practice. They practiced a religion. And in that process, you know, every Sunday people went to church. They prayed. They had a spiritual practice. People don't go to church very much in the United States these days. They've moved away from religion, and the religion kind of became materialism. And I think there's a great emptiness there, that if your life becomes about, you know, what kind of car am I going to get, what kind of clothes am I going to get, and all of that, it can be fun, you know, and delightful for a short time. But ultimately, it does not satisfy the heart and soul. And I think that is leading people to be very much in despair. Now, there is a small but growing movement about changing the dream of the North to one of preservation rather than acquisition, to preserving the environment, you know, to preserving life. And to letting go of more, you know, because there's no end to the more. So that's my opinion. And in my work, I always try to lead people to some sort of spiritual practice. Not just to say, I'm a spiritual person, but to actually have a practice that they believe, that they feel, leads them into contact with the divine, however they define that. Last year when I presented here, I said the research says that people who have a spiritual practice, who attend some sort of spiritual practice, church or temple or whatever, once a week, live 7 years longer than the average. It's good health, good physical health, good mental health to have a spiritual practice. And I think that's been lost largely in the West. Did I answer your question?